You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of March 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, Islamic State bulldozes the ancient Assyrian city of Nimrud. Is there anything the international community can do to protect sites of historical significance? Also ahead, South Sudan peace talks break up without a deal.
We come here to come and negotiate, and we depart from here. It doesn't mean that we have faith.
South Sudan's top negotiator there. We'll also discuss the release of the Kremlin critic, Alexei Navalny, and the gold bars and ornaments weighing 27 kilos that were discovered in a North Korean diplomat's hand luggage at a Bangladeshi airport. We'll also touch on the topic of the surprising political power that heavy metal music might have. My guests are Martin Plaut and Jeffrey Kaufman. They'll be giving us their views on those stories and more right here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. It is 1 minute past the hour here in London. Let's take a look at some of the main headlines of the day. IS militants in Iraq are believed to have bulldozed large parts of the ancient Assyrian city of Nimrud. We'll be talking about that story in more detail with my guests in just a moment. Here in Britain, meanwhile, broadcasters say they're going to go ahead with a series of US-style pre-election television debates, despite Prime Minister David Cameron's refusal to take part on their terms. Indonesia, meanwhile, has said there'll be a short delay in the execution of two Australian men convicted for drug offences, raising hopes an appeal could be lodged. And in Argentina, the family of prosecutor Alberto Nisman, who was shot dead the day before he was due to testify that President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner had helped conspire to cover up Iranian involvement in a bombing of a Jewish centre in 1994, say they believe he was murdered. A couple of front pages. One that struck me, the Sydney Morning Herald we have here. Welcome to Club 100. A fine photograph on their front page of Victor Lederer, age 100, suggesting that the many more Australians expected to live to that ripe old age over the next 40 years, around 40,000 people, have nothing to fear. That's a nice positive one on the front pages of tomorrow's papers. We start, though, today in the studio with my guests Martin Plaut and Jeffrey Kaufman, with one of those big stories of the day, the destiny of the ancient Assyrian city of Nimrud. Iraqi officials say IS began demolishing the site, which is over 3,000 years old, yesterday. The head of the UN's cultural agency has already condemned the systematic destruction as a war crime. Martin, perhaps we'll start with you. I guess the immediate reaction is one of just, you know, horror at these incredible cultural wealth, this incredibly rich history that's potentially being lost.
Well, indeed, but, you know, it fits perfectly within the Wahhabi kind of approach that Islamic State has. You know, they believe that anything that isn't very strictly within their purview of the way that Islam should be interpreted must be erased and is blasphemous. Therefore, it is not a question of whether it should be done. It must be done in their view. And what they believe is that they're doing the right thing, just like the Bamiyan Buddhas were blown up in Afghanistan. And, you know, it's just part of the pattern. I mean, if you go to somewhere like Somalia, they did exactly the same thing. The same kind of view meant that the beautiful old mosques and tombs that there were of Sufi saints were razed to the ground because it was suggested that people were worshipping them, and this had to be eliminated. You can only worship God, and there can be no representation of any human form. Nothing can be shown like that. So, I mean, from their point of view, it makes absolute sense.
Jeffrey, it's a sort of a damning indictment of the particular brand of sort of nihilism of these people, that these things that have endured so many different challenges over quite literally thousands of years are now being raised. It's a sort of a terrible indictment, really, isn't it? As if a further one were needed.
You know, it's a funny thing when you see ancient artifacts, irreplaceable artifacts, destroyed, and you feel this sense of a dagger in your own heart, and you think, well, wait a minute, I feel that way when I see people suffering, yet these objects are gone forever. You know, I think Martin on a theoretical level is right. But listen, you know, I there's no point being nice about this. These guys, there's no intellectual basis for this. These guys are just morons who are out to make their mark, to show that they're men better than the rest of us, and to I think a lot of it's about inciting us. I think the unmasking of so-called Jihadi John. I mean, these are people who are alienated, angry, and they want to lash out and get back. And there's nobody saying, this is sensible. Human beings don't do this to their own history. You know, this is what we are about. We are able to record history to celebrate where we've come from. This is where human civilization began. And, you know, for me, this is a deeply personal thing, because in my many tours of Iraq covering the Iraq War and its aftermath, in 2003, just after Saddam fell, I was embedded with the Marines in ancient Babylon. And I have to say, in my 30 plus years of journalism, it was one of the oddest and most exotic and the most thrilling experiences, because they had made ancient Babylon the Marine camp. And so I actually slept under the palm trees surrounded by the walls of ancient Babylon, which they had done this strategically so that it couldn't be looted. But, you know, here we were, you know, surrounded by these 3,000-year-old ruins. And I know exactly, you know, what Nimrud looks like, because Babylon is, of course, you know, of a similar vintage. And this the sense of being there, of seeing something that so few people have been able to see, because Iraq's history has been so tortured, and now to know that, you know, Nimrud is gone, and you know, in Syria Aleppo is gone, it's devastating to think that a whole culture is losing its history, and really the world is losing its history.
Martin, there are some other examples. You mentioned the destruction of the Bamiyan, but as we think back to the scares in Timbuktu in Mali, where we had, again, similar groups threatening to destroy these ancient manuscripts. Now, it turned out in that instance that some of these precious relics had been discreetly removed. People had sort of got wind of what had gone on. But I guess that's rather difficult to hope anything equivalent can happen when you're talking about these sorts of things that appear on such an epic scale. They can't exactly be secreted, you know, somewhere until this trouble passes, can it?
Well, thank goodness they actually have. I mean, if you go to the British Museum here, you will see bulls with wings, which were taken from these kind of sites. And they are there, and they have been saved because they've been removed from areas where they are now clearly in danger. But let me disagree with you. You call it nihilism. Jeffrey called it moron. They're morons. They are neither of those things. They are absolutely coherent ideologues. They just happen to have a completely and utterly different ideology from the one that I hold and the one that you hold.
I think you
and
give I'm them sorry, too much cannot, credit.
No,
I'm
sorry,
you're
wrong.
I don't think there's
wrong.
An intellectual
you cannot,
foundation.
You just cannot. It is simply wrong, and it undermines our understanding of what they believe and where they come from. And their views are endorsed and supported by the Saudi regime. That is the reality of what's been going on. They have huge money that's been put behind them. If you go through the Horn of Africa, you will see people who believe exactly what they believe, and there's plenty of money behind them. They are not morons, they are not nihilists.
But Martin, that's a risky road, isn't it? If you start to say that there's an ideology there, does that not confer some legitimacy?
Not.
Doesn't it risk conferring a legitimacy that shouldn't be there?
Absolutely not. I never thought that Stalin was a moron or a nihilist. I never thought that Hitler was a moron or a nihilist. I take these people seriously. I think they are
I think
appalling.
The leaders need to be, but the followers have just completely checked their own brains and said, yes, I'll do it.
Well, this is not true. They do not look at the world the way you do.
Isn't there a risk that this is not considered? There's not an ideology. The individual, as Jeffrey alludes to, who's taking a sledgehammer.
In that case, you just don't understand Wahhabism.
Well, no, but if he's taking a sledgehammer to a statue in a museum in Mosul, for example, there's surely a case that this is someone who's reacting to his immediate surroundings, he's reacting to even peer pressure, perhaps. There's no way of establishing that someone has a coherent ideology who's engaging in this sort of activity.
You just don't understand his ideology. That doesn't mean that he doesn't have one.
And the same rationale then applies to people if they attack individuals or take hostages or execute them. Is that the basis of an ideology?
And Martin, I'm just not clear. Mohammed Mwazi, the unmasked Jihadi John, does he have an ideology, or is he just a disaffected, angry man lashing out?
He has an ideology. He has a completely coherent ideology. It is one that I completely and utterly reject. But that's neither here nor there. We're not discussing me. Just as I completely rejected Stalinism, it is a completely coherent ideological position. Doesn't mean it's right.
But I don't buy that. I understand what that on a large scale, on a macro level, some of the preachers behind this may in fact subscribe, fit into that classification. But I think when you look at Muhammad Mwazi, I don't think it's ideology that's driving him. I mean, if you read his biography, there's a real tale of a guy who just kind of disconnected and was disaffected and felt imprisoned by MI5 and by the UK snoops who were on his tail and who escaped and lashed out. I mean, this is I just don't buy that beheading in his case is motivated by an ideology. It may be a self-styled justification, but I think it's giving him too much credit. He's just a bad person.
No, this is just wrong. I mean, if you look at it's just like trying to understand fascism and the Nazis by looking at what the concentration camp guard did. You have to understand what fascism was in order to understand why it came about. And you can't go around judging fascism by the concentration camp guards' motivation. I mean, they were doing appalling things. You know, my own relatives ended up in the concentration camps. I'm not in any way supporting them. I oppose it in every...
Nobody thinks that you're defending Mwazi or the...
But to think that these are morons or nihilists is simply to misunderstand them.
Well, let's throw this forward and say we've charted some of these events. We've made some broad comparisons, whether it's the Bamiyan Buddhas or the scrolls of Timbuktu. What can be done, Jeffrey? Must we just look on and say this is a terrible loss to our global cultural heritage? Or is there any way that, can we even hold out any hopes that some of these treasures will endure, perhaps?
Well, some of them have endured. I mean, one of the horrible ironies of this is that these people are financing their crusade by selling a lot of treasures on the black market. I mean, that's part of what's come out. So they're there. Where they've actually ended up, whether it's in Kazakhstan or wherever you want to believe that these kind of things go, or someone's home in Manhattan, for that matter. Some things have survived. We don't know what, and we may never know what, but some of it's there. I have to say, what I was wondering today, do they sit in the Situation Room in Washington and say, can we send drones to take out those bulldozers? I don't know. The horrible thing about these conflicts is that, as horrible as it is to see these artifacts go, there are millions now. I think it's 2 million is the official number of people who've been displaced in Syria. I mean, the human toll is just unbearable, and yet we're not talking about that.
Well, perhaps that's a legitimate question, Martin. Do you think there is a problem that there does seem to be a slight disconnect? There's an outrage, there's a shock, which I think Jeffrey spoke very eloquently about earlier when these things are lost. But, there are thousands, millions of people at risk, people being killed, people who are displaced. Is there a problem that it almost seems that sometimes these material sort of impacts can be felt more profoundly by some people than some human suffering? Is that an issue, or is it just part of a wider understanding of the issue?
I think it's invidious to try and make that kind of comparison, because it's chalk and cheese. I mean, every man's death involves me, because I'm involved in mankind, as Dunn put it. But these artifacts are irreplaceable. If they are destroyed, there is no going back. And I completely agree with Jeffrey. It is part of all of our civilization and all of our history that is being lost, and it is absolutely tragic. And thank God, quite frankly, that places like the British Museum and the wonderful museums in America have some of these artifacts, that we will have some record of what there was. And of course, there are, of course, photographs as well. But nothing replaces the artifact in its setting and in its heritage. And that is what we have lost, and there's no going back on that.
I don't know if you noticed, there was an interesting footnote to this story in Baghdad. The Baghdad Museum, which was looted when Saddam fell, it reopened when I was there. Gosh, I don't remember what year it was. Partially, but really not much, to be honest. And now they had planned to reopen it in the coming weeks, but because of all of this looting, they reopened it a couple of days ago. And I have to say, you know, it's hard to say much that good about the government in Iraq, but it was a pretty brave and bold move. And to say that, you know, we celebrate the heritage and the history of the civilizations that have lived here. I would, however, be very nervous about some suicide bomber going in there to destroy it just because he can, because that's unfortunately what we're up against. But it is a small note of optimism amidst all of this grim news.
Perhaps we shall move on then on a small note of optimism. Let's look instead to Moscow. One of the main critics of the Kremlin, Alexei Navalny, has been released from prison after serving a 15-day sentence for promoting a protest rally by distributing leaflets. The rally Navalny was promoting became a morning march instead when his colleague in criticism, Boris Nemtsov, was murdered a week ago. The sentence didn't make Navalny change his views. Fresh from prison, he promised Russia's opposition will continue to challenge President Vladimir Putin, and it will continue his work despite the murder of Nemtsov. Martin, it's a complex picture for the opposition in Russia at the best of times. There are obvious dangers which have been demonstrated over the last couple of weeks. Is there a problem, though, perhaps that there's a lack of unanimity amongst the opposition? Is that something that Putin can exploit? Do we need a more coherent opposition to deliver a more effective counterpoint to the president?
Well, of course we do. But I mean, the real problem is the depth of repression in Russia, and before that the Soviet Union, and before that Russia. I mean, you know, this culture of lack of democracy is so deep and so goes back such a long way in Russia. You know, there have always been these very brave people in the intelligentsia, small numbers, but quite frankly, they are so isolated from the vast majority of the people of Russia, who know nothing but this kind of dictatorial system. And, you know, going through, I mean, with that small glimmer of hope under Gorbachev, before that, you've got to go back to before Lenin. And I mean, you know, it's an appalling history, but I'm afraid it is the one that Russia is saddled with.
Jeffrey, Navalny is sort of heralded as a very effective manipulator of social media, for example. There are some suggestions, though, now that he and some of his colleagues are sort of, they're too focused on delivering opposition that works within quite a narrow part of the middle classes. Do you think that there's a problem that their message doesn't speak to a wide enough demographic, despite that you would imagine would be a huge willingness to engage with exactly their message?
Listen, part of, in fairness to the opposition, it's very hard for them to get on the official state media. Until there's an assassination or a murder, they don't exist. And so, you know, it's extremely hard to have a media strategy when the media is closed to you. And you know, and social media avenues are you know, roadblocks are put up, and social media is disconnected when you try to communicate. So, you know, there isn't really an ability to have a coherent strategy. I think you know you have to fly by the seat of your pants. You know, I think what's interesting about Navalny is that he's really much more of a threat than Nemtsov, because he really is a much more engaged, much more active guy. And I think it was the Wall Street Journal that said he's the man Vladimir Putin fears most, because he does have a profile and he has had traction. You know, he did better running for mayor. He didn't win. I think he got 27% or something of Moscow. But he did better than expected, despite every effort to suppress him. I also think that what this shows yet again, I think, you know, what Martin talks about, it, this tradition of Russian and Soviet values that continues to haunt the country. You see Navalny being charged with fraud, with extortion, all these things. He goes to jail. He's let go. Now he's released yet again after all these charges. And, you know, there's a pattern here with the murder last week, with the downing of the Malaysian airliner. You know, where you know, suddenly Vladimir Putin is investigating the murder, where you know all, there's it's this Orwellian doublespeak that comes out of this country, and you know it's very interesting to hear how the Western press report it, because it's still, you know, there's still Putin is a very effective at sowing seeds of doubt and saying, well, you know, reportedly down by Russian mercenaries, reportedly shot by this. You know, Putin's saying, well, we're going to get these people. I mean, I'm not a journalist who's covering this story, But you do kind of think, well, wait a minute. You're going to get these people? Aren't they your people who did this? Can I prove that? No, but I think all of us think that.
Interesting insights, as ever, from Jeffrey Kaufman and Martin Plaut here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll discuss the indefinitely suspended South Sudan peace talks and the gold bars worth over £1 million discovered in a North Korean diplomat's hand luggage in Bangladesh. Stay tuned.
Culture on Monocle 24 is where you get your art kicks. Just recently, we've welcomed Tracy Emin, Damien Hirst and Anish Kapoor to the show. Culture on Monocle 24 is where you get your musical licks. Just the other day, Gregory Porter, Casey Musgraves and Diane Birch entertained our airwaves. They come round here, then go get their Grammys. Culture on Monocle 24 is your antidote to everyday arts coverage, featuring reports and interviews from everywhere you never knew you wanted to know about, in books, art, music, media, film, and everything from around the world beamed right between your ears. Culture premieres every Monday at 1900 London time, and why not visit monocle.com and iTunes for the archive of over 140 culture shows. Swing by and hear Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24.
Twenty-one minutes past the hour here in London. This is Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and my guests today, Martin Plaut and Jeffrey Kaufman. Now, talks to end more than a year of fighting in South Sudan were suspended indefinitely today in Addis Ababa. No deal was reached between the two warring parties, not even an agreement on when to meet again. Mediators say they'd failed to persuade either side to compromise. The conflict was triggered by a political row between President Salva Kiir and his sacked deputy Riek Machar, which has so far claimed the lives of many thousands of people. More than 1.5 million have been forced to leave their homes. I wonder, Martin, how much should we just greet this news with despair, or should we have perhaps been anticipating something along these lines?
Well, it was highly unlikely that they were going to produce a result. But, you know, the analysis of, or the verdict of the Ethiopian Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn is right when he says that they have failed their people. They truly and utterly have. I mean, they have gone nowhere to resolve the differences between them, and the big problem now is what to do now. The United Nations has sanctions up its sleeve. The African Union has an inquiry which they've been putting together, which effectively calls for both of these people to be banned from taking any further part in power. And
I wonder, do you think, is that really the only way that this is likely to advance forwards, if both of these individuals, who clearly are not going to be able to establish any kind of middle ground,
in theory,
vacate
yes,
the scene?
But the problem is, how on earth do you bring it about? And, the suggestion from the AU report is that the whole of South Sudan should be brought under African Union governance, in a sense. But, I mean, the chances of any of this happening, I just don't see it. I mean, who is going to provide the troops to do this? I mean, South Sudan, is a vast country, absolutely vast. And nobody's been able to control it ever since the British left in the 1950s. So, I mean, you know, the chance of anyone getting on top of this, and the visceral hatred there is now between Kiir and Riek Machar is such. And, you know, people were taken out and killed in Juba precisely because they spoke the wrong language. I mean, the Dinka and the Noor just, you know, loathe each other. And I just don't see how you're going to get the genie back into the bottle.
It's interesting, Jeffrey, that Martin mentions, you know, when the British were there, you know, many years earlier. Is there a bit of some oversimplification that goes on? Certainly when the West looks at some of these problems, you see various sort of celebrities even unhelpfully sticking their oar in, tending to categorise these things rather simplistically. You know, Khartoum is bad, the South is good. Does this rather give the lie to that and shows that maybe people have been oversimplifying what is a hugely complex problem?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, when the nation state was imposed on these areas, it was an alien concept. But that is the way the world has decided to operate. And now we have the world's youngest nation, South Sudan, formed in, 2011, proving that it's not capable of being a self-sustaining nation, and quickly going from newest nation to that ignominious list of dysfunctional, broken countries that you know, has only, a half dozen or so countries would fit in a failed state, I think is the term that I'm looking for. It is an incredibly depressing and sad turn of events, not surprising. And ultimately, what a series of stories we have today, all, incredibly pessimistic about how the world is coming apart. There is a coherent theme in all of this. It is much easier to topple a regime than it is to build a constructive new one. And that applies in Iraq. It applies in Russia and it applies in South Sudan.
Well, let's actually move on to another one of these potential basket cases then, via Bangladesh, where customs officials have caught a North Korean diplomat with gold bars worth £1 million in his hand luggage. First secretary at the North Korean embassy in Dakar, Song Yong-nam, was stopped on a flight from Singapore on Thursday. The gold's been confiscated. He's been released under the Vienna Convention, but officials in Bangladesh suggest they're going to pursue charges. Martin, is this a sort of instructive lesson in what people try and get away with under a diplomatic passport?
Well, indeed. I must say, I just wonder how heavy these gold bars were. there's an old joke.
Around about 30 kilos, if you're wondering.
Really?
That's not easy to carry in hand luggage in
because
particular.
There was an old joke in South Africa I've seen it done, that if you went to a gold smelter, they would actually place a gold ingot on the floor and say to anyone who could, that they could, if they picked it up with one hand and walked out of the door, they could have it. You can't do it. But this is the diplomatic bag. What is really fascinating is, was he acting on his own or was he acting for the North Korean government? I mean, was this a way of earning foreign exchange? What was going on? And what was going out in the diplomatic bag that earned him this money? Those are the really fascinating
questions. I mean, Jeffrey, does it tell us something about perhaps North Korea, its desperation for funds, if indeed this was someone who was not going on a solo mission?
Well, I think it's doesn't it have the distinction of being the most sanctioned state on the planet? They have no funds, they have no access to technology, they have nothing. You can understand.
They
have an army, yeah, and a starving populace. But yeah, yes. I mean, you can see why they're trying to game the system, and it's not surprising if you were, the insane regime in that country, you'd be looking for ways to bring in foreign exchange. You can't operate the way and clearly their people are suffering. So, I suppose we shouldn't be surprised. I guess. What's the news here? That they're trying to use the black market to prop up the regime. It's a great story.
Perhaps not surprising though.
Right.
Let's finish with one final surprise, just very briefly. Metal music, not the usual form on Midori House, but there's news that Barney Greenaway, frontman of metal band Napalm Death, has called on the Indonesian president Joko Widodo to save the lives of foreigners facing the death penalty for drug smuggling, because Widodo is a fan of said metal music. Jeffrey, I know you're not necessarily a metal fan.
I warned you about this story.
But it's interesting that it's gone. It's kind of gone full circle. We've now got the metal heads as the potential peacemakers, where they were demonized formerly. The music was used in Guantanamo Bay to try and upset inmates, for example. Is it an unlikely sort of evolution of the metal story?
I warned you. You were warned before. I have no opinion about this story. I think the most I can say is a nice alliteration that metal finally gets morals. This is such an obscure story for me. It's really hard to talk about it. But, how strange that these celebrities think that they can intervene and do this. Martin, I want to hear what you have to say. I'm really interested.
Do you have a pressing view to share with us, Martin, on this story?
My view is quite simple. Look, obviously, I'm against the death penalty for all the obvious reasons, because you can never be absolutely sure and all the rest of it. So, I'm pleased if anybody is calling for somebody not to be killed. But on the other hand, why are we intervening? Just because it's a European granny, she was caught with, $1.6 million worth of cocaine. Look at the harm that she was going to inflict on thousands of people. And now we ask some weird guy from some metal band, I've must say I've never heard of him or the band.
I thought you were a metalhead.
Oh, no, more Bob Dylan, my ear, I'm afraid.
Let's leave it there. We'll end
probably
on Bob Dylan.
Probably yours as well.
time is sadly against us. Martin Plout and Jeffrey Kaufman, thank you both very much indeed for joining us here on Midori House. That's all we have time for on today's programme. The show is produced by Marco Sippi, research by David Pleasant and Kate Bullivant, and our studio manager was Weidong Lin. Monocle's international playlist continues next at 1700 hours. It's The Menu with Marco Sippi. This show is back at the very same time on Monday, 1800 hours, London time. From me, Tom Edwards, that's all we've got time for. Goodbye.